walk in our office and saw him there, and might tell one of our... We were always trying to protect our own stories against the opposition papers and to be sure that nothing leaked. And people who might have an interest in informing another paper would be less suspicious about me having coffee with a man in the restaurant than if I were over in a corner of our office talking to him. Because they used to watch me pretty closely, so I talked with them. What I did particularly when a good story, like the Reuther story, which was good for a long time, was developing. We hoped developing. Well, this man told me that he knew the person who shot Walter Reuther. He gave me his name. He told me he's in Chicago. And that he could get him to tell me the whole story. But, and the fellow was going to give himself up. That he had a good defense. It was a very involved thing, but we couldn't slough anything off, and so his story at the time made a little more sense than it would now, because we had had some other bits and pieces of gossip and information or misinformation that seemed to blend in with his story about this man in Chicago. So I said, well, let's get a plane, we'll go over to Chicago. He said, no, I wouldn't ride a plane. I said, well, we'll drive over and have a car. He said, no, train. So we took the train. First, I called some people at the UAW who were working hard on it and told them to be on the plane and others meet us at the station, because I didn't want him to get out of our sight at all once we got in Chicago. Now, this guy was believable. He was a man in his late 60s, not too well-dressed, but well-spoken, and he didn't talk about getting any reward or any money or anything for the information. And we got on the train, went to Chicago. And one thing I thought I detected about the man was that from his manner, from the way he sat, almost without moving at all, was that he spent a lot of time in prison. And I tried to draw him out in prisons and got no place. For instance, when the train stopped at Michigan Central, stopped at Jackson, and I said, this is Jackson, this is where the biggest biggest Michigan prison is, and also the biggest prison in the free world. And you can see part of the old one from the train. I pointed that out to him. You can't see the new one. And he showed no interest whatsoever in Jackson Prison or any other. And I was sure of this one thing about the man, but he puzzled me on the rest of it. Well, I said, I've got, when we got to Chicago, I had noticed the UAW people on the train, and also I saw some in the station. So I told this man, I've got separate rooms for both of us at the Palmer House. And he said, no, I don't want to stay there. He said, it's too late tonight to do anything. And I'll go to my place where I like to stay in Chicago and meet you in the morning. So nothing I could do but agree to that. And I had him, followed. I went to the Palmer House. And it wasn't long before I got a call from the UAW people who were following him that they'd lost him. He had gotten, it developed later, he was a very suspicious guy, and was constantly doing things to throw off anyone who might be following him. In fact, he told me a couple of days later, or day, I believe the next day, he said, you know, I was being followed, but I shook the two guys who were following me. And he said, so if I am, you probably are being followed. Now what you do is, and he gave me several maneuvers, standard maneuvers to throw off, that are employed commonly to throw off people who are following you. In turning corners and suddenly making it an about face and going right back the direction from which you've come, going through buildings, various things like that. So I thanked him very much, but I said I thought he was being overly suspicious. And he said, no, he said, they'll never follow me very far, but he says, there's somebody trying. I said, well, how would anybody know that we're in Chicago? He said, I don't know, but somebody does. So I said, fine. Now, the next morning, he called me, as he said he would, and we had a date for like 2 o'clock that afternoon for me to meet this man. At 2 o'clock, my informant showed up with an excuse why the other man couldn't be there. He was sorry, but he was going to be a day late, but he'd be there the next day. The UAW was, you know, very high on this situation, and they induced the prosecutor, then Jerry O'Brien, and a couple of his assistants to come over to Chicago to be there in case the thing developed. Because, as I say, they were picking up little things around Detroit that sort of tied in with this, you know, story, which it seems, you know, absolutely without any foundation or any credibility now. At the time, it seemed they had some, enough, so we couldn't throw it away. Well, I couldn't take the man to a meal. He preferred to eat alone. He didn't want any money, wouldn't accept anything. They followed him, by the way. They did succeed in locating. He went to about a fifth-rate hotel on Halsted Street, where he stayed. Seemed to be familiar, and just roamed around Chicago when he wasn't with me most of the time. The next day, he had another excuse. The next day, and I'm getting a little bit naturally suspicious of these excuses, and also the existence of this person, whether he's a fictitious character or whether he really existed. So I said, I can't fool around much longer. You're going to have to get me this guy, or I got to go back. He said, 3 o'clock this afternoon, you'll be, I'll have him, etc. So we made an appointment. In the meantime, I got a hold of a couple of detectives in Chicago, friends of mine, and met them and told them what was going on. I said, look, this guy coming to my room tonight. When he gets back in the lobby of the hotel, grab him. All I want to know is, who the hell is he? What's this all about? You know, does he know anything? And why this runaround? So the time I said, it's the final chance. I'm going back. The man couldn't come that day because his little boy was taking a coat hanger off the closet bar, and the thing slipped and hit his eye, and he had to rush him at the last minute to the doctor. Always an elaborate excuse like this, including the little boy's name and age and how serious the eye was injured and how sorry he was. So it was that night that I had him picked up, and police asked him who he was, what he was doing there, and he said, well, I'm visiting Chicago, I own property here. And he said, why, what's your interest in me? What are you asking me questions for? And they said, well, we check up on people who come to town, people here from out of town. He said, it must keep you pretty busy, which I thought was kind of funny, considering the size of Chicago. So they held him overnight and fingerprinted him. And I was dying to see the result of the fingerprints and developed it. His police record went back to 1902 or something like that, went way back. And he had served time for everything under the sun. But con games, robbery, burglary, arson, the whole bit. Never around Detroit. Mostly in the East and also Illinois. So, with this knowledge, I went in to see him when he was still in custody, and I raised hell with him for being careless and getting arrested. Now, any secret plans that we might have to solve this thing, as I went out the window. Well, he said, it's too bad, but I won't spoil it. He said, you just take me out of here. And go, stuck at it. And I said, no, I won't. I'm not going to do a thing. You can stay here forever as far as I'm concerned, but I'll take you out with me on one consideration. You just tell me what this is all about. What the hell did you bring me to Chicago for? He didn't know that, you know, probably eight other people from Detroit and the same thing with me. I said, well, tell me why you brought me to Chicago. I don't know who this person is, where I can find him. And he says, oh, no, I won't tell you that until I got out of there. Well, we went back and forth on that. And I said, well, you're just going to have to stay. But he had, so I left. And, of course, they were going to release him a short time after, which they did, because they had no reason to hold him in. But he wouldn't tell the police anything else, except he talked about the yellow kid, Weil, with whom he had... was a confidence man and a thief, and he worked with him many, many years ago, and he talked the Chicago police, the old-timers in the department, were getting quite a kick out of him because he knew so much and was talking frankly to them about the things that he had done before. Of course, he knew they had his record. But he wouldn't tell them anything about us. To this day, I don't know what that thing was all about, and I never was able to get any farther. But I had kind of that isn't the end of him. That wasn't the end of the story, because about a month later, there was a news. I was reading a New York paper, and it seems that two New York detectives had been tailing two arsonists, and they were setting fire to a loft building. It poured the gasoline, ignited it, it exploded, and it killed one of the detectives and killed one of the arsonists, and the arsonist who was killed was my alleged informant. So that was the end of him, but I don't know. He wasn't crazy. He was an interesting guy to talk to. Well, I say he wasn't crazy. I suppose he had to be crazy to get involved in any way, anything like that, because I don't think he had any knowledge of the Reuther shooting. He remembered every detail that had been printed, but he didn't offer. I knew the thing inside and out by then, of course, having been working on it for months, but he didn't come up with anything really new. He was always going to produce this guy, and he had a good man who did it and had a good reason to do it and would tell me the whole story. But never did he want anything. You know, usually they want money or they want to get out of jail, and then they'll tell you, or they want something. This guy didn't ask for a thing. There are others. You get a big murder that the papers will be playing for days and headlines with all of the developments. And crime stories used to be the big stories, of course, then. And people would walk in the office and say, well, a man would come in, he'd look sensible enough and say, well, your work is over, I did it, I want to tell you about it. So you'd have to then usually take him someplace to a hotel room, you know, run down everything he told you. Because you couldn't afford not to, just to slough it off. And you'd find eventually that after he had worked very hard on the things he was telling you that he didn't know a damn thing more about it than you did, or than that had been in the newspaper. This was the common one. The bigger the headlines, the more apt we were to get a convincing one. It was rarely a woman. It was almost always a man. Now, I suppose a psychologist or psychiatrist could have many theories regarding this type of behavior. And I suppose also that it varies with the different people who do it and their motive. But if they want attention, they sure as hell get it, because we always took them seriously, unless they were just obviously off. But the ones that I remember were convincing, seemed intelligent, and were just doing the thing that they would explain to you, that they were doing this because they thought it was the duty of a good citizen to do it. And a man in Chicago, I didn't want him locked up particularly, but I just had to get his fingerprints, had to have him checked to see who he was and what this was all about. So he did one night accept my invitation for a bottle of beer. We're on North Clark Street, I think. We went in a kind of a beat-up bar and he ordered a bottle of beer. Or I ordered a bottle of beer for him, I guess. And he drank it. I thought, well, my plan was to get the bottle and to get the bottle to the police and have them get prints off of it and see what they could do with it, resorting to getting him arrested. See what they could do with the prints. Because the chances are you can drink a bottle of beer out of the bottle and you're going to leave enough prints to be identified. But he kept moving his hands when he picked up the bottle so that any print that he would leave would be completely smudged, obliterated. He never touched the bottle where he would leave a print. And this, I think, was not accidental. I think this was by design. I think he was determined not to leave fingerprints anyplace. There's always a completely uniformed policeman assigned to the Detroit Times to keep the alley clear for the circulation trucks and to keep order around the building. And the one I remember who was there the longest, as a matter of fact, he was there when I first got there, was a man we'll call Mike. And he didn't really have much of a very distinguished record in the police department. And this was sort of a safe place, I guess they thought, to put him. Well, theoretically, I outlined what his duties were. There was traffic and keep order. But he was very hard to find because he'd usually be in a blind pig in the neighborhood. He had, during the week, he'd drink on the house. In other words, he wouldn't pay for his drinks. On Sunday, however, he'd get all dressed up in civilian clothes. He'd be in uniform all week, in civilian clothes, and come down to the same blind pig and spend money all day long buying drinks for other people and drinking himself. I don't understand this way of going, but that was his way. Now, he only, in all the time I knew him, many years, he tried to make one arrest. He wasn't very successful. He was chasing someone he thought was a thief down Times Square, and he started to shoot at this guy. Fired a couple of shots. He didn't hit him, But he did hit a girl on the third floor of the book building across the street, who was a stenographer sitting in her office typing, and one of the bullets aimed at the man running in the street hit her in the arm. This is about the kind of cop he was. One day I had an attorney call me, and there'd been a murder in Detroit, and this attorney was a friend of mine. He said, "Rab, got so-and-so, that is the man accused of the murder." And he said, "I'm going to turn him in, but I thought maybe you'd like the story. Do you want to take him in? And then I'll show up later." And I said, "Well, sure, I'll know that nobody else has it that way and have the story." So I met the two of them. The man accused of murder got in my car. His picture had been on the front page of the paper several days. And I wanted to tell my office that development, that I was on my way, because it was getting kind of late in the day. And I had written the whole story in the past tense, and it was being held in type so we could come right out as soon as we got to police headquarters. So I went in the office to tell them that, also to take another reporter with me who could get on the phone as soon as we got to headquarters. And when I drove up, that would have been quicker than telephoning, because there wasn't a phone there. When we got up to the side of the Times, there wasn't a place to park, but Jake happened to be out. Mike happened to be out for air. And I said, "Look, Mike, come here. I'm going to triple park here. Watch this car and don't let anybody tow it away or come near it, police or anybody else." So Mike, for the 15 minutes or so I was up there, stood guard over the most wanted man in Detroit and never knew until the day of his death that he was standing over the most wanted man in Detroit. He thought this was just some friend of mine. And I didn't have the heart to tell him, although if I had, I don't think he quite would have understood it anyway.
This is September 4th, 1971. Ray, there is a further story that has some connection with the Detroiter, also known as the LaSalle Hotel.
Yeah, I don't know when you're referring. It got a big play in the newspapers at the time, and I covered it, and recall quite a bit about it. A man named Howard Carter Dickinson, who was a New York attorney from a very top law firm, was in Detroit to settle an estate, the Yawkey estate. It was a very big one. And he was having dinner at the then Book Cadillac Hotel, where he was staying. And at the next table were three girls and a man. They got acquainted in the dining room. Now, the girls had questionable backgrounds, put it mildly, and so had the man. They joined parties and took Mr. Dickinson for a ride around Detroit to show him the scenery. When they got to Rouge Park, Schweitzer, who was the man with the three girls, pulled out a gun to hold him up. Now, it developed in the trial that the girls were not surprised by this holdup. They rather expected that. But what they didn't expect, none of them, was that Schweitzer then killed the man in cold blood and left his body in Bruce Park. It was found, and the detectives went to work on it right away, and they didn't have to work too terribly hard, because these people were pretty bad, pretty incompetent thieves. They left, and murderers, they left clues all over the city. Many people had seen Dickinson and them eating together, saw them together in town. And the three girls and Schweitzer lived at the Detroit Hotel. Right after the murder, they all, four of them, hurried back to the Detroit Hotel and in the middle of the night, checked out and told the room clerk they had to leave town. So the mother, by this time they were identified, the police had not too much trouble identifying all four of them as having been with Dickinson, and therefore Dickinson, and then therefore being the prime suspects. The mother of two of the girls, who were sisters, lived in Detroit. And the police intercepted a telegram from the sisters sent from Fort Wayne, Indiana, to the mother, assuring her that they were all right and they'd be in touch with her again very soon. The Detroit police then had the Fort Wayne police arrest them because the girls even gave their Fort Wayne address in the telegram, and arrested all of them. They were brought back to Detroit, and their trial was in Recorder's Court, and it was one of those wild ones because the girls were screaming throughout the trial. They were scared to death. They were overcome by their emotions. They didn't think that they should be tried for murder because they didn't understand that a death caused during the commission of a felony is murder in Michigan, I guess both states. They were found guilty quickly. The only question in anybody's mind was, of course, I think they felt a little sorry, the jurors even felt a little sorry for the girls because while it wasn't passing, according to testimony, to agree to the robbery, certainly murder was something they hadn't even considered or would not condone. But they're all sentenced to life in prison. And Schweitzer was sentenced first, and he yelled and fainted when the sentence was passed. His two sisters were then called before the bench, sentenced to life in prison. They both screamed and fainted. And the next girl was called up, sentenced to life, and she screamed and uttered, which I think is one of the classic lines I've ever heard in a courtroom. The judge pronounced the life sentence, and she said, "I'll never live to serve it." I haven't figured that one out yet. But,
well, further point of information, Ray, wasn't the victim, Mr. Dickinson, the nephew of a
United States Supreme Court Justice? Yes. Yeah. The girl who said she never lived to serve her life sentence didn't have to live until she died because she, as well as the other girls, were given new trials after they'd been in the House of Correction for about 5 years, and they were freed. But the man served an awful lot of time. He might still be in prison. I haven't checked lately, but I saw him the last time I was up at Jackson Prison, so he served a lot of time.
Fact, it occurs he might live to serve it.
He might live to serve it.
Ray, let's talk about the Tony Chabotaris case.
Well, Tony Chabotaris was a bank robber who, with a partner, stuck up a bank in Midland, Michigan in the summer of 1936, but here to be verified. And while the holdup was in progress, a dentist with offices on the second floor of a building immediately across the street from the bank knew something unusual was going on. He took a deer rifle and stationed himself in the window. And when the bank bandits came out shooting, he shot and killed Shabbatorus' partner. Shabbatorus was confused as to where these bullets were coming from and saw the sun reflect on the visor of a bank guard, the visor of a cap visor of a bank guard. Shot and killed the bank guard. He thought, Shabbatorus thought that he was the one who killed his partner. Then there was a Shabbatorus jumped in the car and drove it himself, but was caught before he got out of town by some of the local police. So the whole job was bungled. He incidentally was slightly wounded, Shabbatorus. It was a federal case. The bank had federal insurance and initiative. It was a federal case, of course, the bank being under federal jurisdiction. So Shabbatorus was tried for murder in Bay City, Michigan, where a federal judge from Detroit often held court. In this case, it was Arthur J. Tuttle, the late Arthur J. Tuttle. And Shabbatorus had no defense to speak of. He was quickly found guilty of murder on federal property by the jury, and this makes a death penalty possible because of the federal jurisdiction, even though the state of Michigan does not have capital punishment. And no one had been executed at that time since 124 years. Shabbatorus was kept during the trial, and the night after the verdict came in a jail in Saginaw, which is a town near Bay City, like 12 miles away, because it's a newer jail and was considered much more secure. So I don't know, but many of us, all of us, reporters from Detroit, had the same hunch. One, that his sentence was going to be death, because knowing Judge Tuttle, we all felt that he wanted that on his record. He wanted to be able to hang somebody before he retired as judge. He'd kind of done everything but hang him people before, and he never had the law to invoke capital punishment until this case. Then, by doing everything up to that, I mean, he was always getting the limit in sentences, despite any circumstances at all. It was almost invariably the limit. A man stole a ham from a railroad car. During the depths of the Depression, to feed his starving family, and he was caught, and federal sent him to federal prison for some ungodly number of years. You know. This man was not a thief, naturally. He just stole out of desperation to feed his family. No previous record. At any rate, we also felt that Shabbatorus had tried to kill himself. So I talked with George Stark. Now, some newspaper people who are friends do practice now, a thing we call syndicating. That is, one protects the other. You can't be two or three places at once, or you might have two or three people. You have an agreement that if anything happens where you are, you'll let the others know. So I said to Stark, look, I'll go to Saginaw. George Stark of the News. I'll go to Saginaw and make a connection with the jail. And if he tries to commit suicide tonight, I'll call him. You, in the meantime, keep in touch with the judge and all the attorneys, both federal and defense attorneys, who are staying at his hotel in Saginaw in case anything happens.
Bay
or I'm at Reno. Pardon?
Bay City.
I beg pardon, Bay City. And Lawrence McCracken was covering for the Free Press. He had gotten his work done early, so when the verdict came in, he just had a phone in a lead because it was late at night. And for the first time during the whole trial, which lasted about 3 weeks, he was drinking that night and drinking pretty good. So, he was through work, no reason he shouldn't, except his liver. And went to bed quite late and just got in bed when two things happened. I heard a siren and my telephone rang almost at the same time. I answered the phone. It was the jail telling me that Chavez had cut a throat and a wrist with a razor blade he found in his cell. It seems there's always a razor blade in his cell, in every jail in the world. And that they were taken to the hospital, and the siren I heard was the ambulance. So I called Stark and told him, and I said I was going to the hospital right away. And I told him also to tell McCracken. Now, it was too late for McCracken to do anything with the story because the Free Press was all through printing for that night. But I wanted him to know it anyway, just so he wouldn't be embarrassed by his office having to tell him the next day. I went to the hospital and thought that Chavez was in pretty bad shape, but there was a chance for him to live. And he was took him to surgery right away. George Stark came down, and I said, I told him what the situation was, and said, "Where's McCracken?" And he said, "Well, that son of a bitch," he said, "he'd been banging at my door all evening while I was trying to write my story." And then I called him, I knocked on his door and called him and told him what happened. Chavez tried to commit suicide. And he said, "Get out of here. I started that rumor and went back to sleep, so I can't get him up." He wouldn't believe it. He had been going running around the hall drunk, telling everybody earlier that Chavez said killed himself, and that was before the verdict was in even. But Chavez's son was taken to, taken very good care of, as I say, and lived. It seemed that the government was just determined that he could get the best possible medical attention, so Judge Tuttle wouldn't be disappointed. And he wasn't. They transferred him out to Chavez out to Milan, a federal prison near about 30-some miles from Detroit, near Ann Arbor, really. And kept him there and built, cheer him up daily, built the scaffold just a few feet from his cell window so he could watch the progress. The sentence had been passed. He was to be hanged on a certain date at daylight, and hell nor high water couldn't get in the way of it, and didn't. You want to show you?
Well,
knock this off and then go into the hanging later.
All right.
Because that Judge Tuttle, of course, didn't seem to be satiated with this one hanging, which did take place. Later, he sentenced another man who, during World War II, who was found guilty of harboring an escaped Nazi flyer, escaped from a prison camp in Canada, sentencing him to be hanged. And I wasn't here at the time that I was covered the sentencing, and President Roosevelt later commuted that sentence, and the first, hanging seemed to whet Tuttle's appetite, and they tell me that he sort of went all to pieces after Roosevelt took his decisive act in saving the guy's life. And he didn't live too long after that. He was, of course, I suppose he took his philosophy was, what the hell can you expect from a Democrat like Roosevelt anyway? He's a communist and a Nazi, you know. He was that kind of a guy. He was a fine, fair-minded man. I will always remember with great admiration.
We might mention that case involved Max Stefan.
Yeah, Max Stefan was the man he sentenced to be hanged because he helped this Nazi flyer. Stefan was a boob. He had a little restaurant on East Jefferson Avenue, and before and at the beginning of World War II, he had Bund meetings in the back room of his restaurant. And of course, everybody in Detroit knew about it and looked at him more as a clown than anything else. He really didn't accomplish anything. He didn't help the flyer to any degree. He took him, when the guy got to Detroit, he looked him up because he was the most prominent Nazi in town, I guess. And he took the flyer for a meal and then to a whorehouse.